Welcome to Hail Varsity Radio, the voice of Husker Nation. Insight, opinion, expertise, with the biggest and best names talking Nebraska across the state. Join the show on Twitter at Hail Varsity and at Schmitz_radio. Call in at 402-466-ESPN or 1-800-825-5865. Here's Chris Schmitz.
Welcome to it into Tuesday. Hail Varsity Radio, presented by the Nebraska Lottery. Oh, that's a fumble on the goal line.
I've never seen that happen before.
I'm the only one that's been in the studio for 12 years here, so that's on me. Welcome to Tuesday. Let me screw this thing in. Elijah, how the hell are you?
I'm good. I'm glad we saw that music bed playing there. It kind of kept something going through that whole calamity.
I was just moving my microphone up and...
See, the thing is for the people who are listening, it just sounds like you're, like, drunk fumbling around in there.
Well, maybe. This is coffee. It isn't good coffee, but it's coffee. So, yes, we are off to a roaring start. So, here's what's going to happen. This open will resemble what we're going to talk about in the second part of the show. That's YouTube Tuesday. That's Nebraska, Ohio State 2011. The comeback. And the show will go much better than the first 45 seconds, much like the first half.
Hopefully.
I'm quite confident. I don't know who's Rex or who's Levante in the room here, but we'll go with it. But yeah, YouTube Tuesday, we've been doing this all spring long, and we spend time with a former coach or player and kind of go down memory lane. And Ohio State 2011 is one that I'll never forget. I know, Elijah, you won't forget. And the post game, not just the recorded audio that was released, but sitting next to our old friend Dirk as he got stared down and then dismissed by Coach Politi. I mean, legit, next to him, like scooch away. That was intense. But the comeback for Nebraska is the talking point, and it was phenomenal by the Husker offense, the Big Red defense, and kind of a had-to-have-it win as they were on the heels of Russell Wilson in Wisconsin. Spencer Long going to join us, standout Husker offensive lineman, all-conference performer, and he's with the Buffalo Bills, 6 years in the NFL. So Spencer Long going to be with us in 1 hour. Derek Peterson, Dr. Petey, we'll talk to him about his Hail Varsity yearbook story on the Big Ten transition. I can't wait to read that and just get into some thoughts with him on Spielman and the Nebraska receiving corps. Mitch Sherman is 20 minutes away from The Athletic. We will get caught up with Mitch also on the Nebraska wide receiver room, what's going on with Iowa, and you know, the football return, that roadmap that's been put out for many programs to take, and you know, things hopefully medically, as players get back and work out, they can get into full camp mode here by the end of July. Numbers to get in, 466-3776, 466-3776, 800-825-5865. Find us on Twitter, Chris Schmidt at Schmidt_radio, or Elijah Herbal at Herbal Essence. Email Chris at HaleVarsity.com. So I want to get kicked off here. Good story on ESPN.com by friend Adam Rittenberg, senior writer with ESPN. And it's been about 4 years since ESPN has broken down the college football job tiers. How good a job is ... And that's a fair question. And we'll zero in on Nebraska with just how good a job you think the Husker gig is. Probably a different question is how hard of a job do you think Nebraska is? And, you know, it's been 4 years, and they go through and rank tier one through tier five. And the key to this whole thing to me is it's very, very simple, right? Do you hire a guy that can win? And there's lots of different ingredients into what produces a winning football program. And it's just different based on what region of the country you're in, okay? the Northeast has an abundance of talent, right? But they are probably, aside from Penn State and for a little hiccup, Rutgers, and some Syracuse years, they are not as strong a region for college football. Great population base, a lot of density, but there's not a lot of college football powers in the Northeast part of the country. Your football powers reside in the Sun Belt, down in SEC footprint. You've got a plethora of population and talent out on the West Coast, California, Pac-12. Then you have the Midwest. Then you have the Rocky Mountain region. And you have the Ohio Valley area, right? And you have powers that have been able to mine talent within their own 300 to 500 mile radius. And a lot of programs have to recruit nationally. When you assess the power football jobs and what's most coveted by coaches, every single job you break into tiers because of what type of infrastructure do you have, how far away from talent are you, how easy or hard is it to get top talent, and what can you pay your assistant coaches, all right? And you have some programs that have underachieved for whatever reason. I'm going to circle about four, okay? I'm going to circle UCLA as an underachieving program. I'm going to circle A&M as an underachieving program. I'm going to circle Miami as an underachieving program, okay? And I'm going to circle from the Northeast. I honestly think a Syracuse should be a better football program.
I agree with you on every single one, probably except Texas A&M.
Okay.
Because it's not like Texas has been that great down in Texas for the past decade either.
Well, you can go Texas or Texas A&M.
You can go with both, yeah.
You can go with both. I think there's more oil money, and I know that's not been great as of late, but A&M's been able to hire whoever they've wanted.
That's true.
And they've been able to recruit out of their mind at a high, high, high level. I mean, we're talking, when Sherman was down there, a plethora of first-round top 10 picks, okay? And maybe they get it going with Jimbo Fisher. But they've been 9-3, and they haven't won a conference championship since 93. 27 years, and it was the Southwest Conference when probably half the schools were on probation. A&M was just off probation, okay? So I think A&M should be killing it, and they just don't. They don't beat Texas. They don't get out of their own way. They just don't do it. UCLA, they are hamstrung. I know they play in the Rose Bowl, but how interested are you? I mean, there's a lot of things to do out in La La Land. And as a public school, as hard as it is to get into UCLA, they can't pay what SC can pay assistants. So Chip Kelly's handcuffed. Jim Mora, handcuffed, although Jim Mora did a pretty good job. Terry Donahue kicked butt for a lot of years, but he still had to beat USC. Couldn't always do that when they were good. And the best they've, I mean, UCLA hasn't finished in the top 10 since 1998. And I know Nebraska is going on a bit of a drought themselves. When we get into these tiers, right? I mean, I look at, first and foremost, can you lure the right guy? Can you make the right hire? And part of that is the formula of, what's my access to talent? Can my system thrive? Can I recruit to my system? And with Miami, I mean, they just got an indoor practice facility. Miami's kind of been a dump from a facilities standpoint. They've got a boatload of talent that they got to compete with Florida and Florida State just for in-state, right? On top of everybody else, it invades their state to bring kids out between South Carolina and the Georgias and the Alabamas, Nebraska. You had South Florida and Central Florida really good, specifically Central Florida the last 5 years. South Florida is not that far removed. Lane Kiffin was down there for a cup of coffee. So there are some of the reasonings as to why these programs that have a lot of national championships, they are fun to talk memories about, but they've been dormant for a while. And when you look at the top tier jobs, you've got excellent regional ability to recruit. You can also recruit nationally. You have strong infrastructure. You have a financial commitment to the program. You don't have many financial limitations to hire assistants, to make staff hires. You can do what you want. You're winning. You're winning consistently. You're winning on a national stage. And you're printing money because of the conference you're in and the ability to be on that upper tier. You're in the college football playoff, or you're at least in the conference championship game. So your top tier jobs aren't really that shocking right now. They've not always been a top tier job. Because of the right hire, it made them a top tier job. Bama and Clemson both nailed their last hires. Saban, they ripped away from Miami. Clemson, they hired Dabo and promoted him when Bowden wasn't getting it done. Florida, okay, they misstepped after Urban left, but now that they've got Dan Mullen down there, they're all right. I think Georgia's finally going to turn the corner. Georgia's not won a national championship in 40 years. Think of all the draft picks and talent and 9-3s, 10-2s that they've had. Same with LSU. LSU just won a championship. They won one under Les, and then they won one under Saban. So they've got three championships in the last 20 years. Ohio State, damn, every time they've made a hire, they have seemed to upgrade. And I don't know that you could upgrade from Urban, but the dude they got now is pretty darn good. Texas is underachieved. SC has underachieved. SC is underachieving, again, because of facilities. And quite honestly, they're in a tough situation with their the Pac-12's not a player. SC can go beat anybody anywhere when they're doing it. But because of their facilities, don't kid yourself. When it came to bribing Reggie Bush, he could have gone anywhere in the country. He stayed close to home, and he played in front of a lot of folks. Great, but wasn't the best facilities. Oklahoma's right there. They got their hire right with Bob Stoops. They were able to avoid and get off the schneid of a 10-year wander in the wilderness when they whiffed on the hire, right, after Gary Gibbs was let go.
And they got another good one in Lincoln Riley, too.
Well,
we'll see how long he stays, but that was a home run for now.
It was, but they were kind of mapping this out, and it was because they had Stoops, and Stoops knew when it was time to step away and knew how to replace him. And he was selfless enough to not only leave the cupboard stacked, but also go get the next offensive genius, okay? So you've got your Tier 1 schools I just laid out. Bama, Clemson, Florida, Georgia, LSU, Ohio State, Oklahoma, Texas, and SC. Texas is probably the biggest underachiever right now, along with USC. They finally kind of climbed the heights where they thought they were supposed to be under Mack Brown, but you couldn't sustain the Vince Young era or the Colt McCoy era. Those are two really good quarterbacks you got in back-to-back years. You had 7 years of quarterback bliss, and now they're going 8-5, right? They're just inconsistent. Your Tier 2 programs, Florida State's ascending, and underachieving is A&M. Auburn and Florida State and Michigan and Notre Dame, Oregon and Penn State, A&M and Washington are right there. The thing that makes Auburn so difficult is their fan base, man. Boosters are problematic. Boosters are majorly problematic historically at Auburn. Michigan, I know they've only won a couple of titles in almost 70 years, but they do get talent. They have the right guy there at Harbaugh. Listen, man, Brian Kelly's got a tough job at Notre Dame, and he's done really well. He's done very well at Notre Dame. They've at least gone to the college football playoff or played for a title a couple of times in the last 8 years, a playoff appearance 2 years ago, title, and then they got stomped by Alabama. Oregon's been able to kind of buck the trend. They've got a really good coach in Cristobal. They had, of course, Frost and Helfrich and, of course, Chip Kelly that was the system that kicked off the spread. Let's be like Oregon. But Oregon was able to brand themselves, and they got Uncle Phil there from Nike. That's what separates them. Because Oregon, they can go to California and recruit. But in all honesty, Oregon's they're like the three star that turns into a five star. Okay, the tier one are your five stars. The tier two are your four stars. Oregon's kind of your three star that turns into a four and a half star. Your three stars are your tier threes, and Nebraska's in that mix. Do you think Nebraska's a tier three job? Do you think Nebraska should be a tier two job? Do you think Nebraska should be a tier one job? Nebraska used to be a tier one program, but from a job standpoint, it's always been tier three or tier four. And that's not a knock. That's just a reality. Nebraska had 50 years of Devaney and Osborne. That's your difference. You had two of the best ever, maybe the best ever, for 25 years in Osborne. You had consistency with a coaching staff. You had a unique system. And not everybody was on TV, but Nebraska was on TV. And they just hit. They out-recruited you. They out-developed you. They were able to be in the top 10 every year, it felt like, or at least the top 12, or they were playing in big games. They didn't get embarrassed. They had a little bit of a swoon with a seven-year bowl losing streak, but they were as consistent could be. And for Nebraska to be a Tier 3 job, that's a fair assessment. There's facilities. There's fan base. There's more recruits this 2021 class regionally than there's been in a lot of years. But above all, it took a special coach to make them a Tier 1 program. But it's always been a tough, tough job. You have to have a special person to compete at a high level. More with Mitch Sherman next.
And we're back.
Fellas, you think we could listen to the radio?
On Hail Varsity Radio, presented by the Nebraska Lottery.
Yes! That's awesome!
Back with you, Hail Varsity, presented by the Nebraska Lottery. Do we have any duct tape in the studio?
Let me look around real quick.
Well, there's got to be duct tape around a radio station.
At least there's got to be some, like, electrical tape or something.
Yeah, we'll get this microphone fixed. Mitch Sherman's with us from The Athletic, at Mitch Sherman on Twitter. Mitch, what's up? How are you?
I'm good, Chris. Just waiting on some storms here.
I know. Do you have the wiffle ball bat to combat the apple-size hail?
I hadn't considered that as a... an option if we get hail tonight. But I was busy rearranging my patio furniture so it doesn't blow away.
See, I FaceTimed Junior before the show started and said, hey, have you moved the furniture back closer to the patio? It's like, no, I was just showering. So it is officially summertime at 3:30 when my kid's finally showering for the day. So
there are days. There are days in the last few months, Chris, where I have to say that I've been in that boat myself.
Well, I will save judgment. That's all right, man. Just sit down and give me a keyboard. I like it. So a lot going on, and I want to kind of get your take on what's next for Nebraska with wide receiver, with the news of J.D. Spielman. Really enjoyed your story, Mitch, on The Athletic on Spielman, and also just what options Nebraska has, and specifically the attrition that's happened since the end of 2019. Are you concerned about the attrition, and what does the loss of J.D. Spielman mean to Nebraska's offense for this 2020 season? Can you, with a group effort, fill those shoes?
Well, I don't think you look at the numbers, and there's been 14 scholarship players who've left the program since the end of last season, and that's a high number. It's like 20% of the guys on scholarship almost. So I don't think you look at it necessarily, though, and draw any great conclusions specifically because of the number. There are a few, Spielman included, you put Henry Gray, Darian Chase, Noah Vedral in that category, that Nebraska clearly did not want to lose. Mm-hmm. And then there are some whose time was up at Nebraska. If those guys wanted to continue on and have an opportunity to play. And then you have a few who didn't have an option to return, who were dismissed from the team. So if all 14 were in the same category as Spielman and Henry Gray, the last two to leave, that would be a much greater concern. Part of this depends on how Nebraska replaces those guys. And there's not really any way that, well, you'll have some walk-ons who are awarded scholarships in August when school starts. And I guess that's a way for Nebraska to get up to the 85-man limit. You generally want to be able to do that with one or two guys a year, but if you're in a position to do it with five or six, even for a semester, that's not necessarily a great sign for the growth and development in your program. So I think that's where Nebraska's at right now. And this in some ways is still, I would say, residual from the coaching change 2 years ago and Scott Frost's culture and his system taking hold. I don't necessarily believe that this is what you'll see every year, although changing rules with the way the transfers work could, make those numbers go up annually. So we'll see when you get to the 2021 offseason, what Nebraska's looking at in this same area. As for JD, it didn't come as a shock by any means. So maybe in light of that, the loss appears minimized a bit, at least as far as what Nebraska has to do next at that receiver spot. As I looked at the receiver spot over the last 2 to 3 months, I often visualized it without him because there was so much uncertainty around his situation since he took that leave of absence in early March. So Nebraska's going to turn to a lot of youth, I wouldn't put Omar Manning in the youth category. He's an experienced guy at the collegiate level, has played at TCU and in junior college, but new to Nebraska, he's a guy who has to step up. And, your returning players like Wandale Robinson and Cade Warner, you're going to need a lot, of course, out of those two, in addition to some of the other newcomers and players who redshirted a year ago. So we'll see who steps up. But they have the bodies, they have the talent, and more importantly, they have the size this year, I think, to be a better receiving core, even without JD, than what this team had a year ago.
Let's take Omar Manning off the table, and let's take Wandale and Warner off the table. And I know Cade was injury-prone and riddled last year, but he still tried to give what he could. Is there a name that you're excited about this upcoming season? I mean, yes, Omar Manning, but beyond Omar, and you kind of know that Wandale was really ready to come in and contribute. Of the newcomers, of some of the new names, is there a player you're intrigued by?
Yeah, definitely intrigued by Alante Brown. And he's a guy with a little more experience, too, because he spent a year in prep school. And then he had the semester, what there was of the semester in Lincoln, to start to get into the program. And, despite just two practices, I think there's a benefit to him spending time around the Nebraska football program from January through the middle of March. So I feel like they can expect things from him. I feel like the coaches, from what little we heard on March 9th, at the outset of spring practice, are excited about what he can bring to the table. And I also look at a guy like Marcus Fleming, who is going to bring you real speed to that position as a guy from South Florida, potentially as a kick returner and as somebody who can play multiple positions on the offensive side. All of the you could have said this a year ago and it didn't pan out in 2019 with those true freshmen, except for Wandale Robinson. You could have said the same thing a year ago, that there was a lot of promise in that true freshman class. But I feel even stronger mm-hmm. about it this year with Matt Lubick in charge of that spot, a new fresh perspective and a really, really talented true freshman class. We haven't even mentioned Will Nixon, who I wrote about last week and is an exciting guy in this offense, played a ton of running back his senior year in Waco, Texas, is the son of a coach. And of course, Xavier Betts from Bellevue West, who's another guy with Manning that gives Nebraska size on the outside.
Mitch, you mentioned how exciting it is to have Lubick come in and be leading the offense, but should Husker fans be concerned that there's going to be a new offense with a lot of new fresh faces and just a lack of spring practices? Is that a concern going into this 2020 season that the Husker offense may start the season sluggish and take some time to actually get their feet wet?
Well, that's why I think this summer period is really important to make up for lost time. Yeah, I mean it's better than the situation you'd have if you had a brand new coaching staff. The schools that are bringing in whole new sets of coaches in this strange off season, this abbreviated off season, or in some ways canceled time in the off season. I think those are the schools that need to look out the most for playing below what their highest efficiency level is when the season begins in September, assuming it begins in September. But, we've seen some reports of a plan for the way that college programs around the country are going to work themselves back into shape. It's going to be a different kind of July and a different kind of August, I think, than what we've ever seen in college football, as long as things still stay on track. And that's a time for Nebraska offensively to come together. And in some ways, I think Nebraska can use that to its advantage, because Omar Manning, Xavier Betts, Marcus Fleming, Will Nixon, those guys at the receiver spot, you talk about the whole offense. You can include Savion Morrison and Marvin Scott at running back in that same conversation. Those guys weren't going to have spring practice with Nebraska, didn't have spring practice with Nebraska. And this time that essentially makes up for the spring in July, when there's an extended period potentially of opportunity for coaches to work with the players, all those guys are going to be there. So maybe Nebraska can be in a position, I wouldn't say even better, but closer to what it wants, because it has all of the newcomers working with the coaches through that extended offseason practice.
Mitch Sherman's with us from The Athletic, Hale Varsity Radio, at Mitch Sherman. Mitch, about 3 minutes here. Your reaction to what's happened at Iowa, Chris Doyle, the strength and conditioning coach, on administrative leave, and I know you've spent time around the Iowa program in the past. What do you make of what's gone on there in Iowa City?
You could never say with something, I spent a lot of time in 2015 in particular, but the middle part of the decade covering the Big Ten for ESPN. 15, of course, was the year Iowa went 12-0 and was a few yards away from winning a Big Ten championship and potentially going to the college football playoff. I'm surprised that it appears to run as deep as it does, with the inequity and injustices that have occurred systemically, it seems, in that program. I'm eager to see what kind of action Iowa puts into place. There have been a lot of things said here over the past few days, and we'll find out over weeks and months to come how that impacts change at Iowa. I'm pleased that Iowa players have more of a voice now. That's something that I felt, you can even go back to that 2015 season when I spent more time around that Iowa program than I ever have. And I felt then that there was something lacking as far as the players being able to have a voice. And honestly, assistant coaches having a voice in that program has been lacking for a long time too. And I don't know that that's something that's going to come as a result of any of this. It's generally been a one person, a one leader out front of that program, and that's been Kirk Ferentz. And I think you're seeing now some of the problems that can be hidden when you have really only one person speaking for the program. Players, sure, you hear from them on Tuesdays during the season, but they have been silenced on social media. And in today's world, it's just not really the way that things can realistically be. And so some change has already come at Iowa as a result of what we saw last week and see continuing into this week. And I think that right there, giving a voice back to the student athletes, is an important first step in this change.
Mitch, I've got about 45 seconds. Can I hate to do this, put you on the spot. Can I keep you for like two more minutes on the other side? I have a couple more questions about Iowa. Okay?
Sure.
All right. I don't want to run you up against the break. Hang on for me, Mitch. More with Mitch Sherman here shortly. As we'll talk about Iowa, what's going on in Iowa City, their reaction. We'll have thoughts from Kirk Ferentz as he put out a video yesterday on Twitter and joined Scott Van Pelt. Mitch Sherman, more with Mitch Sherman from The Athletic, as we're on here with you on a Tuesday with Hale Varsity Radio. You can find us on Twitter at Hale Varsity, at ESPN Lincoln. Mitch, when we come back, Hale Varsity presented by the Nebraska Lottery.
And now, back to Hale Varsity Radio.
Back to you, Hale Varsity, presented by the Nebraska Lottery. More with Mitch Sherman. Mitch, thanks for hanging in. And we're talking Iowa, what's going on in Iowa City, and Kirk Ferentz, his statement on ESPN, and also with a video out. Mitch, back to your time around Iowa. Did kids you've interacted with, did they seem happy? I mean, they were in the midst of an undefeated season, but overall, did they? What was their personality? What was their vibe like? Yeah, they were having a great season, but the Iowa program in general, did kids feel like they, did it seem like they're having fun with what they were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know that even in the statements that we've heard from the players who've spoken out, that they would argue that they didn't. There were certainly things they've enjoyed,
sure,
about playing for the Iowa football program. You know, it's not a doom and gloom situation, even for some of the players whose experiences, as they look back on them, are filled with some regrets. I have not been in their shoes in many different ways. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for me to project on them and say, yes, they enjoyed their careers, 60% of the time or 90% of the time or 30% of the time. They seemed, my observations, yes, that the Iowa players seemed united. They seemed together and happy and, of course, excited about winning in the year that I was there most often in 2015. Now, there were other years, too, where I spent time around the Iowa program, and often in their games against Nebraska, I've been around Iowa players. I don't know how great of a window into the culture you get when you're standing in the lobby of their football complex on a Tuesday afternoon for 15 minutes talking to 8 different guys, or in a controlled environment in a room off the locker room at Memorial Stadium or at Kinnick Stadium, where you're talking to, again, 4 or 5 guys over a 20-minute stretch, just trying to go around and get sound bites and words on what happened in the game. Iowa doesn't allow, in most occasions, for media interactions to occur where you have the opportunity to really sit down and go in depth with the guy. Now, I've had some of those interviews. Mm-hmm. I spent some time before the season a couple of years ago with Noah Fant in that kind of a setting. And no, in those environments, I've not gotten the sense that, Iowa players are, have had some need to, scream out that they were being mistreated. Not at all. So that's why I think, it requires a sense of understanding, and, you need to be skeptical, I think, about everything that's going on wherever it might be. Iowa is certainly not alone in having players who have felt like this. It's one of the few schools at this point where we've heard some of these accusations and statements about the way things were running the program. But I am certain that this environment exists at other places in the country too. And sometimes it takes one player, like you had with James Daniels at Iowa, who begins to start the conversation, and then others feel more comfortable falling in line. So, I'm sure this is a story that is only beginning to develop, not just at Iowa, but around the country. And, we'll continue to hear some things as the offseason goes on, and perhaps quite a bit longer than that.
Mitch Sherman's with us from The Athletic, Hail Varsity Radio, at Mitch Sherman on Twitter. Mitch, last thought, and thanks for sharing your thoughts and your coverage, your time around the Hawkeye program and your insight to what's going on with Iowa City. So we were discussing the different jobs and football programs, the tiers, the tier one jobs through the tier five jobs. Overall, if you had to circle like one program the last 15 years that you think in your eyes has underachieved the most, if you give me one program, who's that team? Who's the team that's underachieved the most?
Are we including Nebraska in this discussion?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. And I'm kind of torn. I thought UCLA should and could be better, right? I think A&M should and could be better. And I think Miami could and should be better. Those are kind of my three. And I think Nebraska is in that conversation as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about 15 years, Nebraska had a stretch under Bo Pelini where it won 9 or 10 games mm-hmm. every year. And that was an extended stretch. And there are programs that would look at that over the last 15 years, generally traditionally high-achieving programs that didn't reach that level at all at any point in the past decade and a half. So I don't know that Nebraska would be at the top of the list. Also considering that there are programs that have resources, I mean, natural resources like, your location or your weather or your recruiting base that far exceed what Nebraska has, even in the best of days. So, I'm with you, and I look first at those programs that are just rich in resources, like schools in California. And UCLA is a great case. I think Miami is a good case. I think Tennessee is a school to look at also that just has not been at the mountaintop, so to speak, and doesn't really have any reason not to have had success that is on the level of other schools in its conference. So, they would all be there. As I look around the Big Ten, I don't really see anybody though that would fit the category of underachieving on a level quite like Nebraska over the past 15 years. And that's not meant to smack Nebraska down. It's that Nebraska has a higher ceiling than many of the schools in the Big Ten, and it just hasn't reached that with any kind of regularity since joining mm-hmm. the league.
No, that's very fair. And, a lot of these teams that we're talking about have a common denominator, and that is turnover with their coaching staff. I mean, it's not just the assistants that are bolting, it's they're reshuffling the deck, so to speak, every 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, Texas is another one that I would definitely consider. And the Longhorns played for the championship in 2009, mm-hmm. But it's been nothing since then, or very little. There's the Sugar Bowl win, and we're back with Sam Ehlinger. But Texas should be like Ohio State or Alabama. It should have, all kinds of opportunities to win big. And that has not happened over at least the past decade.
Yeah. Mitch, you have a good rest of your week. Thanks so much for a few minutes today.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Take care.
All right. There he is. Mitch Sherman with us from The Athletic. And that's fair. I mean, and I think Nebraska fans feel that a little bit. I mean, we're talking tears, Elijah, and not the kind that tend to go down your cheek with Sooner Magic or a last second field goal against Texas, but just the tier of the program. And for Nebraska to be in a tier three that's a good location, has access to regional recruits, solid facilities.
Yeah.
I mean, the money's there to spend on assistants like never before because of Big Ten money. The support staff, second to none at Nebraska. Great administration. I think they've got a really big-time coach and a good staff. But again, we're part of that T word again, that transition.
Well, with success, the Huskers could realistically get to a tier two, I think.
Well,
the only thing they really lack is a good recruiting hotbed.
Right, and it looks pretty damn good now when you look at all the top 250 talent between here and Council Bluffs, the region, 500-mile radius. We'll wind down hour one next.
And now, back to Hail Varsity Radio.
One final time this hour, YouTube Tuesday. We'll kick it off next hour and revisit the 2011 Nebraska comeback against Ohio State. Spencer Long, good to be with us. Good stuff from Mitch Sherman. Got a double shot of Mitch. Derek Peterson coming up at 5:25. Reminder about drinking and driving. 1 out of 3 fatal crashes involves an impaired driver. Driving drunk, buzzed, or high. Never acceptable. Law enforcement officers working around the clock to stop with sobriety checkpoints and saturation patrols. As a driver, make the correct choice of a non-alcoholic drink or a pre-selected designated driver. Be smart. Start the conversation. Who's driving home? Brought to you by the Nebraska Department of Highway Safety Office. Two things that are harder sells for Nebraska. One is that access to talent. There is talent generationally. You had a lot of kids out of Nebraska. If you look at a lot of the starting positions on the championship run teams, there were a lot of Nebraska kids that were starters. Either Lincoln or outside the metro areas or inside the metro area. But you have that that haven right now of between Omaha talent for 2021, 2022 that Nebraska has access to. But traditionally, Nebraska's always kind of had to recruit nationally, but build from within via the walk-on program and kind of pick their 4 to 6 in-state kids that they could get a scholarship to. And that number kind of went up or down depending on the year. The other part of it, too, and this, you want a coach that understands the standard and understands the bar, and that's to chase championships. And you got a guy who won them here. So it was a fit in that aspect. But it is, and it's a good thing to have a demanding fan base. You don't want apathy, right? But you do have, as Barry Switzer put it perfectly in his book, because he lived it down in Oklahoma, got to feed the monster. And feeding that monster means winning big games, winning high-profile games, and being able to be part of that two-part equation. You're one of the other two teams that make a big-time Saturday night matchup on ABC at 7 o'clock that Musburger flies in for or would fly in for, or Fowler now, right? You want to be that prime-time draw. And while Nebraska still draws because of how awesome the fan base is, got to win some of those games. And that's a tough sell. I mean, it's not like Urban Meyer wasn't called or contacted about a Nebraska gig at one point. And this was way back. And his response, why would I go there? You just fired a guy that won 9 games. That wasn't good enough. And that wasn't necessarily a fan base thing. That was an administrative thing. So that's two parts of this tier thing, your resources and your fan base. And that's why folks are, we talk Auburn a little bit, and Auburn's folks are weary, man. If your Gus Malzahn's on, you feel like, do I call a real estate agent this year? Is this the year that they finally oust me because I've not done enough for them? I've gotten to a national championship game, right? I've followed a look at Gene Chizik, for God's sake. And I don't know how great a head coach Gene Chizik is, but he won a national championship with Cam, and he's on ESPN 2 years later. YouTube Tuesday next. Spencer Long, Nebraska, Ohio State 2011 with Hail Varsity.
Welcome to Hail Varsity Radio, the voice of Husker Nation. Insight, opinion, expertise, with the biggest and best names talking Nebraska across the state. Join the show on Twitter at Hail Varsity and at Schmitz_radio. Call in at 402-466-ESPN or 1-800-825-5865. Here's Chris Schmitz.
Back with you, Tower 2. It's Hail Varsity Radio, presented by the Nebraska Lottery. Excited to talk YouTube Tuesday. Standout Husker and Buffalo Bill Spencer Long with us. Spencer, what's new, man? What you been up to?
Not much. Just been at home doing off-season training and walking out on the outdoor field there at the stadium, trying to get some work in there, and then doing our virtual meetings, kind of have our virtual spring ball going on right now. And it's almost over already, and then we got the last little section before the season starts.
Well, I'll tell you what, Buffalo had a tremendous season a year ago, and I know that you're happy to be up in upstate New York. And before we get into Nebraska, Ohio State 2011, have you been able to manage and deal with the Zoom side of things with the pandemic?
Yeah, it's actually been a little more efficient than I thought it was going to be. There's some good sharing tools on there. I mean, everybody can chime in when they need to. You can share screens and, you know, share drawings and watch film. So we're getting a lot of functionality out of it from a meeting standpoint. It's tough, though, not being able to get together as a team and, like, work out and train together and also do, you know, our football-related stuff. And we would have been practicing for 4 weeks and then had a mini camp. So that's the stuff that we really missed out on there, just football-based coaching and practice that we're going to have to make up for or take longer to acclimate to this season. But other than that, it's been going well, and I kind of had to scramble once everything started shutting down here to just try to find some equipment as fast as I possibly could. And I had to drive to Council Bluffs to go get a rack. I had to, like, there wasn't a single dumbbell for sale in town in Lincoln or Omaha, so I looked into some other alternatives and was able to build a home gym and, like, order some stuff online and pretty much become fully functional here in Lincoln without, you know, having to go to the stadium. And so it's worked out pretty well.
Did you go the Rocky IV route with, you know, moving boulders and climbing steep hills, that type of thing?
Yeah, I mean, initially we were looking for hills and stuff like that, you know, because it just, like, simulates the sled pull, or we thought about pushing the trucks around, but I was able to order a sled and get on the turf field, which is what, you know, I prefer to do. And so we didn't really miss a beat.
Spencer Long is with us, YouTube Tuesday, standout Husker on the offensive line. Great career in Nebraska, longtime NFL man up in Buffalo. Spencer, what do you remember about 2011 before we get to Ohio State? You're going into the Big Ten for the first time, that 10-year anniversary into the league's actually Thursday. Was it quite a jump for you?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I didn't really know where I was jumping from. I mean, I knew how I stood out, you know, in practice and all of that stuff. And, I mean, that was my, you know, debut, you know, going out there, learn what I was made of, playing against, you know, Big Ten opponents and major schools and stuff like that. And, it was definitely an awesome experience. And to have that be our first year in the Big Ten, be, like, my first year stepping on the field. And if I'm not mistaken, wasn't that our first Big Ten win against Ohio State there?
It was the first Big Ten win ever, because you were in Madison the week before. And
that one didn't go so well.
Well, it did. It did for a while, and then it didn't. You know, it wasn't.
Right.
It was kind of a tale of Russell Wilson, first half Russell, second half Russell. But what was the mood for you and some of your mates going into that Ohio State game, coming off that tough one in Madtown?
Well, I just remember starting out the game and just being like, oh man, not another Madison. Like, we had a good ranking. I don't know if Ohio State was ranked or not, but I just remember going into that being like, not again. And then, you know, we started to slowly make a comeback there in the second half. And after that win, I just remember being on cloud nine and just having a good rest of the Saturday and really just coming off that such a high off of that game.
Spencer Long's with us. It's YouTube Tuesday, Hail Varsity Radio. Ohio State jumped out to a 10-3 lead, and then that thing grew to 20-6 going into halftime, and then it was 27-6. I mean, still the largest comeback in school history. You guys were able to put up a couple of touchdowns in the third quarter, and then two more in the fourth. Rex put his Superman cape on. You guys did a great job of blocking. And, of course, the Levante David not only tackled to knock Braxton Miller out, but also the strip to really get things in momentum back on Nebraska's side. Was there any panic? You mentioned the oh-no feeling. What was kind of communicated to you by either some peers, or what did you say, or what do you remember from the coaches at halftime?
Well, you have that oh-no feeling. I mean, obviously, just like looking at the score, but you really can't let that creep into how you're doing your 1/11th job, you know, on the field. You know, you can't let that affect your style of play and what you're willing, you know, what you're trying to do. And, you know, just maintaining your level of play is the best you can do, especially as an offensive lineman. Like, you're not going to be able to do, you're not looking to do anything spectacular, just looking to do your job. And it seemed like it was one of those games where it took a while to just click, and nothing was really, no matter what we tried, nothing was working. Nothing was really clicking. And then all of a sudden it all came together when we kept, you know, hammering away at it. And then it really opened up once we, you know, got the game going on, you know.
With Taylor Martinez, I know Taylor had taken some heat after that locally in the media, after the Wisconsin game, and even kind of leading into the Wisconsin game. And I remember Bo's post game presser, and he was excited. He had a bunch of folks from his neck of the woods back for the game, and it was a great comeback. But did you notice anything different about Taylor Martinez that week, or did you guys try and kind of elevate him, lift him up, or was he kind of the same old Taylor?
Taylor was an interesting guy in that aspect. He just, you know, he was always the same old Taylor, no matter what happened. He was just, to me, at least from what I saw and what I heard on the field, he was a pretty level guy, you know. He just was out there doing his thing. I don't think the stage ever was like, you know, anything different for him. Every time he walked out, it was the same. But I think, if anything, internally he was dealing with it. You know, he would say that game was a big, you know, step for him and us as a team and what we can do and what we know we can do. So I'll never forget walking off that field. I remember very clearly Rex's last touchdown. I think it was an outside zone to the left. And, yeah, it's just, we all felt that high going into the following week from that. And if anything, I know for him it should have been at least a big confidence booster.
Spencer Long is with us on Hail Varsity Radio. Spencer, the theme of this Ohio State game has been the resilience of your Husker team to kind of come back and beat that 21-point deficit. When you look at the Husker teams of today, I know there were a couple games last year where it seemed like themes seemed to snowball towards the end of games. Do you think Coach Bo Pelini and his staff did anything to get you guys ready to play out of a hole like you did in that Ohio State game?
I don't know if anything in particular for that, but I know they held really high standards all the time. And I know that this staff does too, but I think we needed that game to believe it. They needed to believe it. And I think that there's a lot of that snowballing issue comes from a lack of belief and because of consistency issues. I just don't see like us really, I haven't seen that game where we really dominate recently or in the past couple of years. And I think that they, in order for that to happen, they need to believe that they can do that. And they have the ability, and in order to believe that, they have to show it as well, and then they can work from there. But if you're going in shaky or unconfident, then that's what's going to happen.
Spencer, is there a moment in that game that you circle or noticed that completely flipped momentum? I know there's several to choose from, but is there one that either on the sideline or either on the field that you said, wow, old Mo's wearing red and white instead of scarlet and gray?
I don't know. I mean, it's been a while since it's the memory's kind of a little bit hazy,
sure,
but
sure.
I just overall coming out of the half at halftime, we knew we had to act quickly and if we wanted to make a change and actually win the game. And I think the pressure was on us. We were used to having, you know, a fire lit under us, and we took advantage of it.
One formation I remember in the game, and Coach Beck would break it out from time to time, is that diamond formation, right, where you got Rex and you got a couple of backs. It's almost like an inverted wishbone out of the shotgun, but I mean, there was no answer for it off of the play action or off of the quarterback run game, and then the ground and pound. I mean, what Nebraska was, not a lot of teams, and I know that Ohio State team was a team that still went to, I think, the Gator Bowl, and they lost to Florida in a tight ball game, but that was a really, really good Ohio State team within, you know, even though it was a transition year post Tressel a year before Urban. But they, I mean, that roster you guys played against on the defensive line was loaded. Their secondary is great. Braxton Miller, Carlos Hyde, their offensive line was incredible. So while it wasn't a vintage Ohio State, you know, a 12-1 type Ohio State, they were a year away from an undefeated season. But touch on that formation, and when do you remember that kind of being sprinkled in? Was that an install for the Ohio State, or was that always a part of your playbook that Beck decided to break out, and it was a great mix of run and pass in that second half?
I think we had it sprinkled in for the whole year. We had our entire playbook, you know, but then as each week comes along, we find some strengths and weaknesses from their standpoint and our strengths versus their weakness and vice versa. And to try to build on that. And I think we were just trying to utilize, you know, our athletes in the backfield and give, you know, Taylor and Rex as many options, and, you know, it really just caused their defense, you know, to kind of stay spread out. And we were able to find creases with their athletes in the backfield from there. And we were able to do some things off of it.
A couple more minutes. Spencer Long with us. YouTube Tuesday. We're revisiting Nebraska's largest comeback in school history against Ohio State. A national game on ABC. The Huskers take down Ohio State 34-27. And the Rex Burkhead Show. What was it like playing with Rex during your career?
We used to call him Captain America. He was just, you know, Rex. Rex seriously was, I mean, he embodied what it was to be a student athlete in Nebraska. He was an all-around guy. He did so much in the community, off the field. He did everything right on the field. Heck of an athlete, heck of a guy, just really high character. And I just remember being proud to be his teammate and to block for him and work for him. And, you know, I just, Rex as a guy, it's just somebody that, you know, just embodied it, and he just did it every day. He was disciplined, didn't say, he didn't complain, he didn't whine, he did it. He's a hell of an athlete, and he really took advantage of his opportunities because he was prepared to do so.
Spencer, as we get you out of here, you're in contact, I assume, with that O-line group, and you had you and you had Searles, and I know Qualley are all you guys ended up in the league, and really good group on the offensive line, and some of you, a lot of you guys came in together. What was that building process like for you and that core group that started several years together? To work your way up, then get on the field, and then see it work out to some 9-10 win seasons.
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was some shuffling of the cards initially, and once we, you know, everybody got solidified, I think we had a really special group. Some of the fondest memories coming from that offensive line room, and still very close with everybody to this day. And yeah, we had a lot of talent in that room. I think, I mean, it goes to show we had a few, me, like I said, me, Qualley, Searles, Stirrup was on that line for, we overlapped a couple of years. I mean, we had Marcel, we had Yoshi, he was in the NFL for a little while, now he's in the CFL. Marcel Jones was, barring injury, an NFL prospect tackle. He was in the league for a few years. Mike Caputo was a hell of a center. Cole Penzick, I mean, all those guys. We just had such a good room. And Andrew Rodriguez was a freak athlete, and I think if he, you know, wanted to, he could have, you know, done NFL stuff. And I don't know, it was just really special to have that type of talent across the board, and I think we could have done, you know, even more together than what we did, just as far from an offensive line standpoint. And it was special to be a part of.
You know, last thought here on Nebraska to the Big Ten, and overall, did you miss leaving the Big 12 and jumping to the league in the Big Ten, or? You know, as a Nebraska native and a guy that grew up checking out Nebraska, do you think the move's been good for Nebraska?
I think the move has been good overall, yes. I think more so, but academically for sure. Athletically, I definitely now, because the Big 12 kind of disbanded a little bit, but the one thing I will say is that growing up watching Nebraska in the Big 12, I was kind of sad that the OU, Nebraska, Texas, Nebraska, all of those rivalries, you know, Colorado, Missouri, all that stuff. I don't know. It was just kind of, it was a little sad to me, but we created our new ones. You know what I mean? So it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. It just was different. But it was cool to do it right when, to be there right when it happened, and to actually start playing right when it happened, because it felt like the beginning of a new phase, and so that was what was cool about it. But I definitely enjoyed all those old school built Big 12 matchups and rivalries.
Spencer Long with us, Buffalo Bills and standout Husker, YouTube Tuesday, Nebraska over Ohio State. Spencer, best to you and continued success in the NFL. We'll talk soon, and thanks for a few minutes today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And we're back.
Fellas, you think we could listen to the radio?
On Hail Varsity Radio, presented by the Nebraska Lottery.
Yes! That's awesome!
Back in Hail Varsity Radio, presented by the Nebraska Lottery. Good stuff from Spencer Long, Nebraska, Ohio State, 2011 YouTube Tuesday. Derek Peterson's with us, HailVarsity.com and Magazine. Elijah Herbal with us. So, right after that game, you had some Huskers, Elijah, show up to your football practice, your youth football practice.
Well, no, what happened was we got a day off of practice, and they let us go down to the Huskers training facility.
Okay.
And watch the practice because Pliny's son was on our team.
Okay.
So we got the little special privilege, we got a little tour of the stadium, and then we got to go watch practice. And at the end of practice, they let all the players come over and talk to the kids a little bit. And Coach Bo goes, "Oh, there's Sharpies over there if anyone wants anything to sign." And I didn't have anything for me to get signed. Like, I liked the shirt I was wearing. Rex Burkhead walks by, and I got the Sharpie, and I go, "Rex, can you sign my arm?" Because it's the only thing I had. And I have a picture somewhere. I'm looking
forward
to it.
Okay, so there's proof of it. Derek, did Bob Stoops ever sign your forehead?
No, I can't say he did.
Would you have let him?
Probably not. Signing a forehead seems a little excessive.
That's fine. We're at different ages, of course. You would have been in your 20s with Big Game Bob, and Elijah was all of, what, 11?
Yeah, 11, 12, somewhere in there.
Did you wear the Husky size as an 11-year-old?
Oh, yeah. I was wearing large shirts in fourth grade.
Says the offensive tackle. Derek, what do you know, man? How you been?
I'm good. How are you?
We're all right, man. We did a little YouTube Tuesday there. Lots going on. And I want to start with the yearbook, bud. And that's in mailboxes and on newsstands shortly. And Thursday's the day for the 10-year anniversary. You've been talking about it the last 7 to 10 days. Nebraska off to the Big Ten. And, my man, you have gone just phenomenal lengths to run down people that lived it, that were part of the transition, that were decision makers, that were also coaches. Kind of lay out just some of the names you've had a chance to sit down with for this upcoming feature.
Well, I didn't get to talk to some of the people away from Nebraska that I would have wanted to, but, you know, and obviously I think the only media Bo Pelini has done was the interview, the sit-down that he did with Sports Illustrated, which is fine. We asked if we could talk to Bo, and Bo wanted to talk to somebody about LSU, and that's fine. We wanted to talk to him about Nebraska, and Nebraska's in the past, and this is certainly a story that, you know, we're focusing on 10 years ago. And one of the things I talked to Tim Beck and Papuchis and Rich Fisher and Rick Kaczynski and Harvey Pullman and some other folks, I tried to talk to James Dobson, who used to be the strength coach, and he declined an interview, respectfully declined an interview. And one of the things that I had to make sure everybody knew before I talked to him was, hey, look, I'm not trying to stir up controversy or anything with the way things ended in 2014. I'm mostly interested in 2010 and 2011. So those the season that you knew you were about to leave, but you were still, you know, trying to win a Big 12 title, because in 2009, you were 1 second away from a Big 12 title. And then in 2011, I had one coach tell me that it was basically, you know, Nebraska gets into a new conference and everybody else in the conference has one bowl game they have to prepare for. Nebraska has 11 bowl games they have to prepare for. Papuchis said the only team that was on Nebraska's schedule in 2011 that was on the schedule the previous year was Washington. And so, you know, you're talking about new tape for everybody and stuff that you can't trust because it's not your own stuff. And so I just kind of wanted to revisit how difficult of a transition it was, if Nebraska actually was ready for it. It doesn't sound like they were worried. Ready is a different word. But I kind of wanted to answer two central questions, being, would Nebraska make the same move again today? And was Nebraska ready for it when it made the move?
Well, and those are, you know, was Nebraska ready? You're still trying to kind of get good footing in the Big Ten a decade later. I mean, it was a major transition. And, Derek, you were down there watching Nebraska-Oklahoma, man. I mean, I remember that Big 12 title game against the Sooners like it was yesterday, where Roy Helou's trying to go Missouri part two, and then the Sooners come back and steal one and do a great job, by the way, of stealing one.
Here was the thing for me. I was 14. Remember, like I was 14 I think, when they left the Big 12. So
right.
One of the conversations that I had with Rich Fisher, actually, and we talked about kind of my experience reporting this story, because this stuff was all, you know, newer to me. I didn't live this like, you know, my editors or some other people that have been covering Nebraska for a long, long time. And so I was talking to Rich Fisher about it, and I was like, look, I remember when I was 14 years old and my dad is watching, because my dad grew up a Nebraska football fan, obviously, and my dad is watching games every Saturday, and he's saying, oh, Bo is only a 9-win coach. Bo is only a 9-win coach. And we talked about that, and I talked about that with a couple of the other guys too. And what I hope happens, and what has happened with the people so far who've read it, is that people will read this, and you know, there will be a conversation about, you know, what they accomplished in those 4 years in the Big Ten, where Nebraska's at now, and kind of where the program was at whenever Bill Moose got here. I've got Moose in the story, quoted a couple times, and you know, it's not excuse making, but I think it's going to restart a conversation, at least amongst the people that read it, of, you know, hey, what happened 4 years ago is directly impacting what happens or what's happening this season.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right on. And those two questions, would you make the same move? Was Nebraska ready? Nebraska didn't have a choice. They dove headfirst into the pool, and it was different, man. I mean, our YouTube Tuesday, that was a big game against an Ohio State team that was in their own transition, going from Tressel to Urban, with Luke Fickell minding the candy store for that one season. That was tooth and nail. The game before, it was Russ Wilson and a Wisconsin showdown. Both teams are ranked in the top 10, and that was a tough second half for Nebraska that night in Madison. A lot of beer spilt on Nebraska fans in Madison, if I remember the phone calls after that game. So what's the general feel with doing it over again? I think from a money standpoint, man, you got to do it again. If you knew you were going to do it sooner than you did, maybe you'd kind of change your recruiting structure just because of the difference between the Big 12 and the Big 10.
Oh, we talked about that. There's an entire section in the piece that's dedicated to the decisions that they had to make on the recruiting front and you know, some of the changes that they had to make from a roster standpoint. And we talked about, you know, those guys are very proud of the fact that Nebraska beat every other team in the Big Ten within their first two seasons in the league. They lost three games that first year, Wisconsin, Northwestern, and Michigan, and they beat all three of those teams the next year. Those guys are proud of that because, you know, I think what it took to do that has been a little undervalued. But to your question of would Nebraska do it again, I mean, from a financial standpoint, it's a no-brainer. Like, people said Nebraska didn't really have a decision to make in the matter. I don't know. I mean, the Big 12 is still alive and kicking, and they're making significantly more money in the Big 10 than they would be making even now in the Big 12 had they stayed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it was necessarily like their hands were tied behind their back and they were dragged to the Big 10 kicking and screaming. You know, one of the things that Harvey Perlman said to me was that this wasn't a football decision. And one of the things that was intimated to me was that this was not a decision that was made by athletics. It was made for athletics. And you look at some of the academic pieces of it. Nebraska as a research university felt it was the institutions in the Big Ten were more in line with what Nebraska wanted to become. And Harvey talked a lot about academic collaboration in the Big Ten, which they didn't have in the Big 12. And so, you know, it was interesting. It was interesting to go through, you know, because obviously Harvey's he wasn't the athletic director. He was the chancellor. So he's got to look out for more than just athletics. But you know, it's interesting to go back now and have some of those conversations.
Derek Peterson's with us, HailVarsity.com and magazine at DrPDHV on Twitter. His feature in the yearbook you want to get and get a subscription. Phenomenal monthly rate for you as a Nebraska fan with Hail Varsity Magazine and .com. The move to the Big Ten 10 years later. Derek, I've got about 3 minutes here. I might need to keep you another five if you're good with that. What was Harvey like to talk to? I'd see Harvey in my neighborhood on the 4th of July because his daughter lived across the street where I used to live. Didn't chat with him much. And that's, you know, he was there to hang out with family. And we were, the adults were having Roman candle fights because we're, you know, we're 40 going on 14. Yeah. How is he? Because, you know, there's a lot of Nebraska fans out there that just aren't Harvey people.
Yeah, I mean, it because of when we're doing this, right, when we're reporting this, I can't meet with any of these people in person.
Sure. No, I got you. But I'm saying the conversation itself, yeah.
It's emailing people and being like, hey, can we talk on the phone? And Harvey was one of the first people that, I mean, he responded to an email within a couple hours of me sending it and said, yeah, let's chat on the phone. And he was great. I mean, he's obviously, you know, with the way everything ended in 2014, there's two sides to everything. And, you know, from what he was able, I'm trying not to give away too much that's in the
thing. No, I want,
from what he was able to tell me, he was good. He was, you know, we had a good conversation. We had a fun conversation. We talked for about an hour and, you know, he answered all of my questions and there wasn't anything where he was like, yeah, I'm not going to tell you that on the record. So okay. I had no issues talking to Harvey.
Well, I mean, that's a great get for this piece because he was really, really important to it. And he's
yeah,
on.
And what I liked was, you know, I asked Harvey, I was like, would you make the same move today that you made 10 years ago, knowing, you know, how the last 10 years played out, being that, you know, Nebraska football, the breadwinner, isn't going to win a conference title and it's going to have the losing season. He said, oh, absolutely. I have no regrets regarding this decision. And then I asked Bill Moos, who at the time was over in the Pac-12 and they were, or what was the Pac-10, and they were looking at Colorado and they were looking at a package of other Big 12 teams. And I asked him, like, when the move was made at the time, what did you think of it from an outside perspective? And he said he thought it was a no-brainer then. And now being in the conference and knowing Commissioner Delaney and knowing some of the other athletic directors, he said it's still a no-brainer now. So everybody, Derek, nobody regrets.
Derek, 5 more minutes on the other side. Can you do that?
Yeah.
All right, Derek Peterson, more with him on the way.
And now, back to Hail Varsity Radio.
For Husker Talk, Derek Peterson with us, HailVarsity.com and magazine at Dr. PDHV is featured story of the upcoming Hail Varsity yearbook, reliving Nebraska's move to the Big Ten. I know we've talked about that a little bit. Great feature. You're going to get the magazine, the yearbook, and the digital goodies. HailVarsity.com, subscribe. That's where you go for that. Derek, some news and notes with the Big Red, the official announcement with J.D. Spielman going to the transfer portal. No, Hail Varsity confirmed that yesterday and not surprised by it. Do you think Nebraska's positioned okay to get some more playmakers the football for 2020?
For 2020, no. They positioned he was going to be playing his senior season, so they weren't going to be planning on him being around past this year, but the reaction to JD leaving has been weird. You know, everybody has been, I shouldn't say everybody. You know, we've been operating under the assumption for the last couple months that JD wasn't coming back. And so, you know, getting confirmation that is in fact the case. And it's one of those things where, you know, we didn't have a knee-jerk reaction to him being in the portal because at least I was expecting that to be the case. I wasn't expecting him to come back. But the knee-jerk reaction from some people that maybe expected him to be back was that, oh, we don't need him, or the juice isn't worth the squeeze. You know, I've seen people say that he wasn't a guy that Nebraska could rely on, and he was a guy that got a lot of his stuff in garbage time. JD had 4 targets in the fourth quarter when Nebraska was trailing by more than 8 points last season and 0 catches. So he wasn't getting the bulk of his production in garbage time. And his third down catches were down from that ridiculous 53 target season he had in 2017, but he was still the second most targeted player on third down for Nebraska at wide receiver last year. This is going to hurt. I mean, look at the guys that Nebraska has in its wide receiver room now.
Wando Robinson is a true sophomore coming off injury, has 40 catches, 40 career catches. Cade Warner, as a walk-on junior, has, I think, 15 career catches. Chris Hickman, as a converted tight end, has one career catch that went for 0 yards. And that's it. They don't have a single other player that has a reception at the FBS level. And I'm high on Omar Manning. I'm high on Xavier Betts. I've written about those guys and what they can do for the offense multiple times. I think on the outsides, they really complement Wandale inside, and they would have complemented JD as well, and it would have allowed JD to go back to playing more of his natural position. But, you know, this is going to be a challenge. And the problem is exacerbated by the lack of spring ball practices. Alante Brown was a guy that they really, really liked, and they got him as an early enrollee, and he's basically in the same boat now as a guy like Marcus Fleming, in that, you know, they haven't had much on-field time with the offense, and they're going to have to roll with some inexperienced guys. You know, Cade Warner is, outside of Wandale, Cade Warner is the most experienced, and you know, we go back and forth in our Hail Varsity Slack channel on just what kind of role he's going to play this year, because I think they're going to really turn to the freshmen and the two redshirt freshmen that they have. I think Jamie Nance could have a decent season, a nice season, redshirt freshman season. But there's no underscoring, you know, just how important J.D. Spielman was. I mean, he's the first receiver in program history to have 3 800-yard seasons. He's your leading returning receiver, and he was going to be a senior. That stuff doesn't just walk out the door and you're just like, okay, bye, see ya. Like, Frost spent a lot of time last season talking about how they need more talent on offense and how they need more weapons. Well, you just lost the biggest weapon you had. Like, you can't just say, yep, it was mutual. We're better off without him. The juice isn't worth the squeeze. He's a distraction. The distraction thing to me was weird too, because what was Maurice Washington?
That's a freaking headache. That's a headache.
There seems to be a little bit of revisionist history happening here. It's been kind of interesting to watch. I hope the best for JD, and hope he can figure out where he's going to play next year. But Nebraska's got to figure out how to replace the production that he had, because even if you think he, you know, ebbed and flowed in the game, and I was critical of him after the Iowa game. I didn't think it was his best performance at the end of the season when Nebraska needed a win for a bowl berth. And he's been a guy that kind of, he's not really involved. He kind of fades away from the game. You can forget that he's out there, and then he makes a catch in the third quarter. And you're like, oh yeah, JD. Like, I've been critical of him for that. Nebraska needed him to be more consistent, but Nebraska just needed him. It couldn't be in a situation where it was like, yeah, you know what? We're fine. We'll go a different direction.
Derek, I know there's still a lot of time until the season, a lot of time for JD to make a decision, but if his choice is Minnesota, as a lot of people seem to think, do you think that Frost...
Assuming
the waiver happens, do you think that Frost would allow that?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think Frost can block it, can he? I don't think coaches can block anymore with the transfer portal, can they?
I think, well... The thing that's unique about this, the way I look at it, and you correct me if you have a little more insight on the NCAA, but since this isn't a grad transfer deal, I know that there's
right.
The free transfer, right? You get a free transfer. That's either that's passed or could be or is going to be passed, right? I mean, that's something.
No, they kicked that down the line.
That is good. Not, so it comes down
yeah,
to
that
an
got kicked down the.
So it comes down to an eligibility question then, doesn't it, from an academic standing?
Yeah, so he used his redshirt season in 2016, and he hasn't graduated from Nebraska. And, you know, there are a couple academic things. He's going to if he wants to play Division I football at the FBS level, he's going to have to get a waiver to do so.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he's going down to the FCS level. And I could be wrong. I guess I'll have to look at this when we get off the radio, but I thought when the transfer portal came into play, I thought coaches were no longer allowed to block. I thought players could just say, hey, I'm going here, and the coach just has to say, yep, you were in good standing with us.
The question is, does he need to get the waiver approved by Nebraska?
is a good question.
To leave. That's where I'm coming. Does Nebraska also see the NCAA is like, yep, you're good to go wherever, son. We know you took a personal leave. Let's just carry it on, go to school this fall, and go ahead and play Division I football. Nebraska, you also need to sign off on it. That's the question.
Yeah, that would put Nebraska in an interesting situation.
That'd be a bad look if Nebraska would block it.
Yes, it would.
Or not sign
considering
off.
Considering all the players that have left, and you had another guy that left and went to Rutgers who you played this year.
Yeah. Like, yep. He's good.
It would be a sticky situation.
Derek, what's coming up here about 15 seconds on HailVarsity.com from you? We've touched your book. I know you have a story up now that's pretty heartfelt, pretty passionate from you.
I finished my 10 Most Intriguing Huskers series tomorrow. Number one goes live tomorrow morning, and I'm also having another section from my yearbook story that is kind of a teaser that'll go live tomorrow.
Awesome, man. Hey, this was fun. Thanks for jumping on with this for some extended time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Have a good one, man. Take care. There he is, Dr. Petey, Derek Peterson. Give him a follow on Twitter at Dr. Petey HV. We'll wind down Tuesday. Hail Varsity presented by the Nebraska Lottery.
Miss us?
Come here, brother. Give me a hug. Bring it in for the real thing.
We're on call for you. Catch the podcast at HailVarsity.com, the ESPN Lincoln app, or download them on iTunes.
Saddle up, partner.
Back to Hail Varsity Radio.
One final time, Hail Varsity Radio on a Tuesday. Good stuff from Derek Peterson, Mitch Sherman, Spencer Long. Podcast will be up HailVarsity.com or iTunes in the individual interviews on ESPNLincoln.com. The on-demand section. Of course, you can stream us, find us on Alexa, or just take us with at your convenience on iTunes or HailVarsity.com. That yearbook's going to be money. Excited for that. Tomorrow on the show, Mike Babcock will be with us, Mike Shewhart, Brad Edwards from ESPN, and then Jacob Padilla. Jacob does an awesome job on kind of an O-line look for Nebraska. So we'll spend some time on that. And Thursday, Uncle Jerry's going to join us. Coach DiNardo, Bill Bender will check in. And hopefully a Vogue's sighting. So Kirk Ferentz took to video, was on SVP as well, and kind of laid out where Iowa football needs to go, wants to go. They're more, I shouldn't say more, but they're less stringent. Sounds like Iowa's trying to change here. And here is Captain Kirk.
I think the biggest thing from our standpoint regarding what's going on currently right now is just that we had a good opportunity Monday night to meet as a team, and then we broke into six different groups. I think there's some great conversation, great discourse back and forth, coaches to coaches, coaches with players, and a lot of individual phone calls. And just trying to see what we can do to help move forward as a team. And then most importantly, just all of our players continue to grow, players and coaches, everybody involved, grow and learn.
That's Coach Ferentz's response on team's response and the topic of respect also addressed here by the coach.
There's no question. The sports have long been, in my mind, the best thing about sports is just what you mentioned. For any good team to be successful, they have to exchange ideas. And the key thing, I think, is being respectful of each other. And I think, probably we could learn a lot in society just from teams that really do things right and function well together.
And Iowa does have an advisory committee in place.
Football is a game of discipline and sacrifice. In our program, we have high standards, accountability, and we have a good team of players, coaches, and staff members. But it's clear we can all do more to creating a better environment, a respectful environment, one where every player can grow, develop, and become the best version of himself. Therefore, I'm creating an advisory committee chaired by a former player and comprised of current and former players as well as departmental staff. This will be a diverse group that will be able to share without judgment so we can all examine where we are today and how we can have a better environment tomorrow.
And you are free to tweet if you're an Iowa player now versus one pre-approved tweet. So changes at Iowa, And, you know, I don't, and I'm glad that former players have said, look, we don't think Coach Kirk should lose his job. I don't know what happens to Doyle. He's pretty important. Can Doyle change? The guys want him around. We'll see where that shakes out. You can't, in my opinion, get rid of Doyle without doing something to Brian Ferentz. He's been implemented in this as well. And I don't know that Dad would take the old hatchet to his own kid. Be awkward Sunday dinner. So, back at you tomorrow at 4 with Hail Varsity. Thanks for tuning in. And we're presented by the Nebraska Lottery.